We're doing satsang today. Om, om, sahana bhavatu, sahana bhunaktu, saha viryam karavavahai, tejasvinavadhitamastu ma vidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shanti.
Do you have any pressing questions? Now's your chance. No, really. Don't worry, if you don't have questions, I have plenty to say. Okay.
I wonder if you could talk about people who have experiences that are where they, from that experience, feel like they've seen who they are,
mm-hmm.
and what the value and the potential pitfalls of that kind of thing is. I was just talking to someone who's had a lot of those and recently, and just wondering if you had anything to say about it.
Well, I think the good thing, the very useful thing about having experiences, like say if you have very samadhi experiences or very expansive experiences or experiences of your of non-duality, these type of things, that those type of experiences are kind of like I call them beacon lights, where you have the experience and you know that it's the truth. There's no doubt, and nobody can tell you that it's not the truth. But the problem is that you don't know what that truth is in terms, contextually. And so the problem is that even though, say you have something like a non-dual experience or a samadhi experience or some very expansive experience, that experience also is kind of initiatory. So that when you have that experience, it's so deep and it's so profound that it puts you in kind of a prolonged state of almost living in a different order of reality that will last for some period of time, and then it will start wearing off. You know. So now, that it's true, that it's real, that you've had that experience, all of that are given, accepted. But contextually, because you don't understand what it is in relationship to the totality of your experience, like the different thoughts in your mind, your emotions, your desires, your reactions, you as a jiva, as an individual within this dual world, what happens to you when you die, all of the things that have to do with this duality that we find ourselves in, you know, tend to overwhelm that experience, and that experience is lost in time. Because the experience, if it's an experience, say it's a mental experience where there's a tremendous absorption in the mind, that experience comes to an end, and you remember it, and you're also deeply affected by the profundity of it, which can leave you in an altered state for some period of time. Okay? But that altered state wears off. And then you're back to where you started from, and then the idea is, how can I get that state, that experience, back again? And so then your idea of liberation or moksha can be, how often can I have that experience, and can I get that experience back frequently, you know? And so can get the experience back more frequently than I can. And so they're higher up on the hierarchical scale. So they have the experience all the time, but I had it once, and I'm trying to get it a second time. Mm-hmm. The whole problem there has to do with experience, that it's an experience in the first place. If it's an experience, by the very nature of it being an experience, it's time-bound. And so then the next question comes, who are you in that experience? Because what is real, or what we call satyam, or the reality, the very being itself of you, is not going to be negated or lost when the experience goes. And so it is true that there are many, many profound experiences that are beacon lights that tell you there is something more. Yeah. And with no doubt, they're spiritual, religious experiences, there's no doubt. But that's what they are, as beacon lights. Your being is not an experience that comes and goes. So say we want self-knowledge. Just imagine, even the use of the words, this is what's kind of come over into this country, just the use of the words itself. Self-knowledge, but we don't take the word self to mean me. If you say self-knowledge, it should be meaning you, this person. Who is the person here? Who am I, the one who has all of these experiences? What is my nature? Somehow, over the course of time, I've become the mind, and the self is something that I have to travel to in some way, or have an experience of, that is other than the me that is here right now. Whereas in all of the Upanishads and all of the tradition of teaching, when the student, the sishya, goes to the teacher and asks, please teach me, who am I? What is this, the truth of all of this? They're talking about, who am I? Not who is the big capital S self, already knowing who I am. I'm just this little person here who wants to have an experience of this, of some self. That's not what the question means. What is the truth of my nature? Now, another thing about that, to really get to, down to the kind of the nitty-gritty of it, when I'm saying, who am I? What is my nature? I'm not talking about a self that isn't here. I'm talking about my own self-experience. I'm talking about me. This me that is sometimes happy, sometimes sad, sometimes lonely, you know, sometimes angry, sometimes anxious. I used to be young and now I'm getting older, right? This me is totally, this myself is totally contained in the web of my experiences, and I have no differentiation. Like, I was sad and now I'm happy, or I was happy and now I'm sad. It's as though in my mind, I, the happy one, has become the sad one, has become the agitated one, I, the young one, has become the middle-aged one, has become the old one, I'm the healthy one, who's become the sick one. So this I is continually getting dressed by all of these different conditions, even though the very one who was happy is the very one who's now sad. There's no fluctuation there. The me, sometimes I'll say, okay, look at it like this. There's sad consciousness and happy consciousness, agitated consciousness. Sad, happy, agitated are different words. Consciousness isn't. Right? So I need the viveka to discriminate, the one that never changes. And then I need to understand the relationship of the one who never changes, who doesn't come into being and go out of being. I have to understand, I have to recognize this, the fact of my own stable being, and then I have to understand, what is the relationship of me to everything else? That contextualizes me. First I have to recognize me, and then I have to contextualize it with this infinite display of duality, and with my body and mind and sense organs. Then I'm situated, my knowledge situates me in my experience in a way that is understandable and logical and non-negatable. So then I have some nishta. But that experience is something that has never not been here. It doesn't have the bells and whistles of some sort of meditative blast. You know? It's very gentle and very profound, and it's the very source of everything that I seek. But it is not an absorbed mind. It is not a nirvikalpa samadhi. It is the self that is there, present to nirvikalpa samadhi, and the same self which is present to dukkha-vritti, to suffering. Right? That self is not changing. So that's the free self. So what happens sometimes, in fact, this just, it happened to somebody that I know, actually, who has been, was teaching, and he had been part of the, gaining some knowledge here and some knowledge there, some from different sources, and so it was eclectic in his understanding, but he had a very profound experience. He'd been studying for a long time, and he had a very profound experience. And so, and he'd also be teaching a little bit, but all kind of eclectic. There's not any kind of traditional study, but just gathering here and there. And a serious and honest person. So, he had a profound, really profound, kind of non-dual experience. And so he wrote to all of his students, "I'm enlightened now." And so he said, "I'm enlightened now." He laughs about this. Right? This guy is a really kind of a really nice guy. But he was serious. "I'm enlightened now. I've understood everything, and I want you all to know, because now I can teach you all of this. Teach you this, you know." And so he was in this altered state, because when you do have some sort of a deep absorbing experience like that, you are kind of you're in an altered state. It's initiatory. It lasts for some time, you know. And so he says all this, and all of his students are coming. They're all excited and happy. And then, after a few months, 2 or 3 months, not very long, mm-hmm. like a bouncing ball, you know, it's like the samsara of the world comes back. And then here you are with just the same old mind, that initiatory experience. I say initiatory because it's so profound. It's like a huge beacon light, you know. It's worn off. And so he just sent out another email. And he said, I'm sorry. I really thought I was, enlightened, but it was just an experience. It's not true.
Stay tuned.
Pretty nice. Mm-hmm. It's pretty nice, you know. So that's, you know, that's what I think about that. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, so there was another discussion that's kind of related that we were having. And whether and to what extent knowledge necessarily leads to or includes a neurological shift, a change in the body. So, you know, what I was saying is that could happen as a side effect of knowledge, but that's not necessarily a way to measure knowledge. For example, I know you've talked about, and this isn't something that we discussed mm-hmm. that night, but Swamiji and the experience of lighting the Book of Matches, and how, you know, because that would be an example of a neurological, I mean, that kind of response happens even before the mind gets involved.
Yeah.
It's like the spinal cord, and that can be retrained. Peter's not here, but, you know, you do martial arts, you retrain your neurology.
Right.
I wondered if you had any thoughts on that.
Well, I think our mental-emotional experience definitely affects our body and our neurology. And so, say, one thing about as you gain knowledge, your mind relaxes more than it ever has before. And the reason that it relaxes more is because it's no longer threatened. The ananda, or the wholeness of the wholeness that you're seeking, is never now something that can be taken away. Because your nature of your being isn't bound by time. It's not an object in the creation. It's the very self of all the things in the creation, but it's a different order of reality. So you can't be touched or taken or stolen away. You also can't ruin it. You know, say you're a bad girl. You know, you're being naughty. and all of a sudden yourself just shrivels up and runs away. That doesn't happen. So nothing can harm you. Nothing can harm your being. Nothing can take your wholeness and your fullness away from you. That gives the mind, it's an end to the search. On a certain level, it's an end to the search. Because your mind is always looking to become whole and complete and to get what it needs and arrange all of these things. So now you can say, ah, all is well with me. And it never happens. You get moments of it, but there's nothing constant. But what about when you discover the source of that, and the source is your very being, and the mind is never away from it? Then there's a relaxation that happens that can't happen otherwise. Because to the degree that you're dependent on your relationships or your acquisitions or getting rid of things within duality to make you whole and complete, you can't really relax because there's nothing relaxing about it. There's nothing stable. But what about when it's completely stable? And so in that level of relaxation, the body relaxes, the nervous system relaxes, the sense of mind doesn't have fear in the same way. It might have instinctual fear, like cars running at you or something like that. But it doesn't have fear, that same samsaric fear. And so that changes. I mean, our neurology, I think, and our muscle tone is changing all the time. So even as you mature as a person, even without self-knowledge, as you become more loving, more relaxing, more interested in Dharma than in sensory, you become more stable, your body becomes more relaxed, so you change in that way. But I don't think that you can gain more relaxation than you can through self-knowledge, because yourself doesn't come and go and you can't hurt it. So that's the freedom, that's the moksha actually. Is that my being as I am is free, and there's nothing you can do about it, there's nothing Ishwara can do about it, and there's nothing I can do about it. So I'm free. It's not going to go. It's not going to get old. It's not going to do anything. It is what it is, and what it is whole and complete. So it does change. Just change your body in a way that is not, in a way that's natural.
And that can take some time. I mean, there's the emotional lag time, and there's just getting used to...
It's definitely emotional lag time. Yeah. Because our mind is so used to... That's why as you gain knowledge, you yourself have little pieces of what I call initiatory experiences where you're ahead of yourself. You know, you gain clarity, and you're ahead of yourself because your emotions haven't caught the emotions that are triggered by the world of your relationships have not yet had a chance to own up your knowledge. Right? And so what happens is your buddhi becomes more stable and clear, and as it becomes clear, your emotions and kind of the, what do you call it, the relational self of your mind keeps, all of those emotions and reactions and things keep rising up into the you who is now different and continues to become different in the sense of more mature. Your knowledge is more clear. And so yet this emotional lag time, all of these ways of reacting and processing in the world keep rising up into your knowledge, and then rising up into your knowledge, then they change in the light of your knowledge. But they have to rise up first, you know. Like I remember when I was first in India in the 70s, and I had been there for some time, several years. And I came back for 6 or 8 months or something to renew my visa, do some things I had to do. And so I had just lived with Swamiji in classes every single day, you know, for all of that time, for 2 or 3 years. And so my reality was different.
Well, that was kind of like an altered state.
Yeah, I would say. And then I land back here. And then I'm seeing old friends and people that I've, you know, been with and family and all of this. And these reactions and feelings that I hadn't had them for years. I'd forgotten all about them. And it's like somebody had brought in a new, remember this closet? Opened that closet up and there's all the old dresses, you know. It was so shocking. It was so shocking because I hadn't even remembered having such feelings, and you know, not even, it was too long ago. But they had just been lying dormant. Just dormant. And I brought them back into the same setting and they rise up immediately. But they rise up in me. The buddhi means my mind, but now is knowledge. They rise up into that mind. And so now I'm totally different in the way I am with those things. So the real shock was that what rose up was exactly, it just had been dormant, the exact thing. But then it was processed quickly, you know? And so that's what happens. All of the habits, all of the habitual ways of being, habitual ways of feeling, all of these things come in back into your knowledge, but you're a different person now. Now, this is true for all of us, even without knowledge. As you mature, you handle your experiences differently because you're a more mature person. But this level of maturity is so much more, because this level of maturity is what we call liberation. Because it's coming into your buddhi, your mind that is enjoying the strength of your knowledge and the strength and changelessness of your own being. And so that maturity is more profound in a way than maturity that is just resting in a cell, in a mind that is still, that you're still totally identified with and is looking for ananda and happiness in the world. That's different. See what I mean? Much different relaxation. And nothing can, you can have any type of thought or any type of feeling can pass through. And nothing happens to you. It's not even about, oh, I'm an enlightened being and now all of my thoughts are just crystal clean and beautiful, shiny, sparkly. And that's not true. All kinds of thoughts pass through, but they pass through a self that is whole and complete and is not tarnished by the thoughts.
Yeah, but when you get a sad thought and it sticks and sticks and sticks, it doesn't seem to pass, or you don't notice your me illumining this, that there's no separation in a way.
Well, I think the sticking part goes away. When you have a sad thought, then there's a lot of secondary thoughts that come around the sad thought. Mm. You know, it's not just the sad thought. The sad thought can be like riding on water. It's something that you're not pushing away. You accept it completely. You are with it. You're not asking it to be different. And you're also not building up on it. Mm. You know, but then what happens in samsara, you know, when we don't have that stable base, you have a sad thought. And then that generates another thought, and then you have a whole spider's web.
A cluster
that then totally encloses you. So, but there comes, I think, just a time, and this has to do also with your willingness to deal with these thoughts in a certain way. You have to be willing, like, to say when you have a certain type of thought, say you have a hateful thought. You know, say you hate somebody and you're building up a whole web around that, then you're just going to suffer that samsara.
Well, yeah, the willingness, though, is to push the thing away.
No, that's not the willingness I'm talking about. That's you're willing to push it away, but you may not be willing to be with it. You may not be willing not to push it away. You may not be willing to relax and let it just be, you know, and see what happens. Either to just let it be or to go into dialogue with it or to actually work with it, you know. That's what we call sadhana, you know, where I my working with these things is a priority for me, rather than reacting to them. My priority will become more and more to work with them in a way that neutralizes them, you know, where I bring my knowledge in. Wait, I'll give David first a minute.
Okay.
So you're contrasting an answer to Michael's questions.
Yeah.
These amazing spiritual experiences that come and go versus, established knowledge or Mishnah. And that makes a lot of sense. But before I came around here, I sure saw a lot of literature that's throughout centuries and thousands of different reports of people that are running around now, mostly from the East, saying that they have a permanent reality of that, what he's talking about. It didn't wear off. They said that, you know, they have God consciousness or cosmic consciousness 24/7. It hasn't changed since they started.
Well,
I'm not saying they didn't grow or develop, but they're saying that their reports are on there. It's not shutting off.
Well, I would say this, whatever sadhanas they're using to get there, there's only one thing that's 24/7. and that's the self.
Mm-hmm.
There is nothing else that's 24/7. There's no mind that's 24/7. There's no body that's 24/7. There's no thought that's 24/7. You know, so to say.
Well, they're not using the term 24/7.
No, but I am. Mm-hmm. I'm using it. Mm-hmm. Because 24/7 means all the time.
Yeah.
So then you have to say, they may be, whatever language they're using, it depends on their tradition of teaching. Now, if they say, I have God consciousness all of the time, mm-hmm. let's look at what do they mean by that.
Mm-hmm.
If I have God consciousness all of the time, well, what that I would imagine means is that I've recognized the permanent nature of my being, and that the permanent nature of my being, this me, that nothing, this mithya creation, nothing is away from it. There's only one non-dual Ishwar. That's what they have to mean. And so they're calling that God consciousness. So you see the problem? It's like they can be using all kinds of terms, but if they're teaching to their students, they can't just say, and probably don't say, I've made it, I have God consciousness all of the time. They have to talk about who is God, the God that they're talking about, and what is the consciousness that they're talking about, and what is the relationship of the mind to that consciousness and to God to say, I have God consciousness all of the time. Otherwise, it's a really far out thing to say, but it doesn't mean anything to the student.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're familiar with the fact that the literature is jammed with these reports, right? I mean,
well, yeah.
There's libraries full of this stuff.
But I'm saying the same thing, though. I could say exactly the same thing. It can be full of all of this stuff,
mm-hmm.
but they should be explaining. Like, even for you to say that to me, that all of these there's so many books, there's so many documents of people
mm-hmm.
saying, I've made it, I have God consciousness all of the time. We have to know what they mean by that
mm-hmm.
and how they got there.
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean?
Mm-hmm.
If they say, if they were to say, for instance, that I had an experience of enlightenment and it's never gone away, I would have to know what they mean by that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'd have, those words aren't enough.
Mm-hmm.
I could... All of us, like, if I said, I've actually done this with some students at CIS in my non-dual class. Say if I took that sentence and I wrote it on the board, and then each one of us then writes a little paragraph
mm-hmm.
or a page of what that means.
Mm-hmm.
So we've done that. And it means totally different things because of your own orientation to those words. And even for how you might be thinking about it, you could be thinking, well, oh, there's tons of people that are saying this in tons of different ways, so that means there must be tons of ways that a person could have a God consciousness that doesn't leave. Well, that's not true. Because if it doesn't leave, it means it's always been there. It can't be something that's come into being and then it never leaves.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always been there. There's only one thing that's always been there, and the thing that's always been there has nothing to do with time. It's free of time. So that is, in fact, your being. So that has to have been recognized by whatever tradition they're using to get them to the recognition of that which has always been there and always will be there. You see what I mean?
Yeah. Thanks.
Just to follow up on Ed's question, in today's class, prior to the session, there was meditation, and you had mentioned that it is possible to change a thought.
Mm-hmm.
But if a sad thought comes, it doesn't go. It's like a psychological noise. It's just sitting
changes
in the head.
Slowly.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Definitely changes, but emotions are much more slow. In fact, emotions are such that a lot of thoughts come within the emotion. You know? Like some of Swami Vagyushananda calls the emotions the weather. I like that. The weather is slower to change than all of the activity that's going on in the weather. The weather changes.
But how? What effort can we make to change it?
To change it?
Mm-hmm.
It's probably a lot of different ones, but I think one of the most powerful is to not push it away. Because usually what we want to do with our feelings and emotions and hurts is not be with them. But the very act of welcoming the emotion, not pushing it away, or the negative, hurtful person or whatever, not pushing it away, that very act allows the mind to relax. Yeah. And the very nature of your being to become more pervasive in a way to that kind of tense mind. And kind of the psychodynamics of the way to understand the reasoning for that is, if you look at the spectrum of emotion from like tremendous, you know, rage and sadness and hatred, all the negative ones that are hurtful that we would like to get away from, all the way up to neutral, to happy, to joyful, to blissful. So this whole spectrum, right, of emotion. You take the negative spectrum, these are from the worst to the least worst, are just different levels of stress and tension in the mind. Even the physical body is a stress and tension in the mind.
Is that stress and tension a thought life, or is it something of a different
Well, say
nature?
If you look, say if you think of your mind with thoughts going on in the mind,
yeah.
Just thought, but the mind is like the weather, it has become stressed. So it's thinking, but there's tension in the mind. And we have different words for this tension. Like a certain type of tension in the mind we can call agitation. Another type we have little names for them. You know, we like jealousy and envy and dislike and hatred and whatever they are, all of them. All of the different negative, sadness, depression, despair. We have names for all of them, but they all have to do with a certain closure in the system, in the mind. And say you look at this, the positive spectrum, we see different levels of expansiveness and relaxation. And we have names for all of those too, you know? Oh, I'm just feeling fine, I'm just okay and normal. That means my mind is just in neutral, and in neutral. And now I'm a little bit more relaxed. And I can say I'm feeling good, I'm feeling happy. And I have a different type of relaxation, I'm feeling compassionate. Different type, I'm feeling joyous. Different type, I'm feeling love, very loving. Different type, I'm feeling bliss, you know. And so if we kind of use this type of, I don't know, it's almost metaphorical, if we use this type of a model, if, say, I have a negative emotion, like, say, negative means one that I want to get rid of, replace, like sadness. Usually what we want to do is push it away, or, you know, push it away somehow or else, creating more tension. Because the mind that's trying to push it away is now adding to the tension of the tension. So now, what if you're not pushing it away? What if you just welcome it? You know, like your child is crying, you put your little child in your lap. You know, and they're there with it and loving and caring. And the child stops crying eventually and runs off and plays. Because, but what if you hadn't done that? What if instead you said, oh my God, you're crying again, go to your room. Which happens.
Tension.
Yeah. And so then there's trauma. Trauma upon trauma upon trauma for that little one. Or we kind of do that same internally. Say there's sadness or hurt, and instead of saying, okay, you be with me, that you'd love to say the words, but that's what it is, you'll be with me, I'll take care of it. You, I love you, don't worry, you know? Then that mind relaxes, becomes okay, and dissipates, you know? And the sadness dissipates.
Somebody's looking after.
Yeah, it's being loved. The other thing is say it needs more than that, you can just say to that sadness, tell me what it is. Tell me what's really hurting you. And let it talk. But you can't have that sadness there and say, okay, tell me what it is. It'll just become more sad, because more tense. So that's why that just get in the habit, if you get in the habit of doing that welcoming, you have to practice it. After you do it a few times, it's just what you do all the time. Because it's so nice. It's so nice to have an inner friend there who cares. And it's not very hard. It's the only reason it's hard is because we don't know about it. We don't know to do that. We haven't practiced it. We have different ways of responding. You see what I mean? Even when we do something like the meditation we did today, really has to do with, there is no reason to push away your experiences. There's no reason to just let them be. They're not covering you at all. It's like, from the standpoint, say the sun is saying, you're meditating, and the sun is saying, get rid of the clouds, get rid of the clouds, they're covering me. The clouds aren't doing anything. I'm illuminating the clouds, right? Clouds are not hurting me in any way. As the sun, if I'm on the earth, and looking up at the sun, the clouds are there. You say, oh, the clouds have to move so I can see the sun. But I'm the sun. So I can allow all of my experiences to be, and at the same time, you know, just being myself, by being myself, I come more to the forefront.
Did you
because I'm the stable one there.
Did you find that you met resistance to do this practice of welcoming and being kind to, say, those negative senses in yourself?
Well, I would say like this. If you're meeting the resistance and noticing it, then you're almost there. Because what tends to happen is you don't deal with it at all.
Mm.
You may have heard it being told literally hundreds of times. But it has not penetrated into your mind that you might actually do something like that. The instant you think, let me do that, then that sadhana becomes a reality for you. And that's a very significant moment. It's a very significant moment because you have no idea how long you can actually go before that moment comes, even though it's been taught and you've done it in meditation and whatnot, it still hasn't become something that is important to you, because it takes a while before your, I don't know, it's somehow this suffering, this anger is important to you because it's deserved. There's a, you know, it's, it deserves, it, it is deserved, that person deserves to be punished. I don't want to be okay. I don't want to do that work to be okay, because there's just a like a self-righteousness involved.
And you sort of...
I don't know, I'm trying to think of the words. I can't think of the right words right now. But
you sort of get attached to the...
Yeah, and identified.
Yeah.
Yeah. Attached to it, identified with it. It's part of your personality. It's part of your self-image.
Not sort of. 100%.
Yeah. Yeah.
For me.
And then there comes a time when you don't want that anymore. You just love, you fall in love with your own shanti and your own nature. And you don't want to relate to the world in such a way where you're jeopardizing that. And for what? For what? Because nobody benefits from it. You don't benefit from it. The others don't benefit from it. Nothing good comes of it at all. But there's certain lines you have to cross over along the way before that becomes real. But once it does become real, then it's a real domino effect, because if I can do it in this case, I can do it in this case, I can do it in this case, I can always do it. So that one crossing over is such an important step. And it takes however long it takes.
In the course of this answer, you mentioned the self coming to the forefront.
Yeah.
And
not that the self is actually moving.
Right. But well, it seems like that what it is that the mind is more relaxed.
Relaxing, and that's what's making that feeling of it coming to the forefront, but it's really just the mind relaxing, thinning out.
And that permits the mind to perceive its
self
more clearly.
I would say the self is
self-evident,
right? The self is shining of its own accord, so the mind isn't necessary at all. But now what happens is that for your own self-shining, for your own being, as consciousness, the mind isn't contributing to that. But it is contributing all of its own thoughts and feelings and emotions and activity and buzzing around and doing this and doing that and looking at this and looking at that. It's contributing its activity. But when the mind starts to relax in that viveka, that discrimination between its activity and the changelessness of its being, then it becomes, that viveka, that discrimination becomes more and more and more natural to the mind. And you become more and more just yourself. You are yourself, and then the thoughts are the thoughts, the emotions are the emotions, and you are you. That's why we did a little bit, we've been doing this in the meditation a little bit these last few times, where you just, as you recognize your own being, then you just put the I there, you just be that, that's who you are. Mm.
So there's no process of forefronting or...
No, there's no, never any motion, but there seems to be motion as you relax, that's all.
Well, but can I follow up with that? The reason I suggested that maybe the mind had something to do with perceiving that was that it's the mind's activity where the self is not in the forefront, where we wouldn't use those words. It's because there's so much going on in the mind.
Yeah.
So somehow there is some process that's affected by the mind or some
initially,
kind of perceiving.
Initially, because what has to happen is that the self, yourself, whether you have ignorance, self-ignorance or not, yourself is always who you are. That's not going to change. And it's always experientially who you are. It is its own experience. Right? But what has to happen, the mind has to not gain knowledge of yourself, it has to remove ignorance. You know, if you think, oh, I'm saying it like that, to gain knowledge would be as though to gain an experience of the self. It doesn't need to gain an experience of the self. I always am exactly the same experience ever present. But it has to recognize itself, the mind, as mitya, as something which, you know, is illumined, not the luminary, is something that continually changes, and the self, myself, remaining constant.
Could you say it kind of gets out of the way, like it becomes a clear water bucket instead of a dirty one?
Well, it becomes that's a good example, but that clear water bucket also happens in any moment of ananda. So what really has to happen is that it has to recognize itself as mithya, itself as objectified, itself as coming and going, and differentiate itself from me that never comes and goes and is always the same. No matter what the vritti, no matter what the thought is, no matter what the emotion is, it doesn't make any difference. I am always the same. And so the mind has to do this process of differentiation. It's the removal of ignorance that is causing this mutual superimposition where the mind, the thought, whatever it is, takes itself to be the conscious being, and then the conscious being is now thinking this. That's what we mean by mutual. The self is not performing any action of being mutual. It's that it's a twofold identification. The mind takes on consciousness as belonging to it, and then the consciousness becomes the one who is thinking, or the sadness, or the emotion, or whatever is the content of the mind. But with viveka, the mind recognizes me, that the self is always the same, that it itself is illumined, it's not the luminary, and that it is continually changing, the emotions are coming and going, but its very being is constant. Its very self, the self that is you, is actually constant, and the thoughts and moods and emotions are changing. You see what I mean?
Thanks, yes.
Mm-hmm. You know?
So, I'm wondering, we're using the word mind, and I'm wondering if you can unpack a little bit.
The word mind?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's this idea of manas and buddhi.
Yes, so let me do that.
So on and so forth.
I didn't know if you knew those terms. So say if we look at the whole sukshma sharira, subtle body, there are what we call the mind is actually four elements. Antakarana is the word, means inner instrument. That includes the buddhi. And the buddhi is perhaps the deepest mind. It's the mind that, it's like the observing self is the buddhi. You know, it's where clarity of knowledge is there. The manas is the fluctuating mind, also all negative emotions, not positive emotions. Positive emotions means the buddhi has become expanded and quiet, and you have all different forms of ananda. It's the negative emotions that create, are all the tensions and fluctuations, that is in the manas. So the fluctuating mind, indecisive mind, negative emotions, manas. Citta is the memory. Right? And then the ahankara. The ahankara is the really a function of the buddhi in a sense, but it's the ajnanam born identification of my being with the thoughts or the moods or the emotions or the body or the sense organs or any what we call upadis, any conditioning adjuncts. So the ahankara born of ignorance is what identifies my being, which is changeless, non-dual, you know, free from time, free from space. It identifies my own being, me, with all of these upadis, conditioning adjuncts. Upadis means any place where the I can erroneously land. So this body is an upadi because I can say I am this body. Or my thoughts are upadis because I can say I am the thought, or I am the emotion, or I am my sense organs, I am the seer and the hear. Those are all upadis because they can take conditioning adjuncts because they can hold the eye erroneously, right? So, so now when we're really talking about doing some sort of sometimes inner child work or dialogue, inner dialogue, it's usually the buddhi that now has some knowledge and can be the inner friend and really a voice for the self, for your own swarupa, for your own nature. It can talk to the manas, you know? The manas holds all the little children, and so, you know, all the agitated ones, all the negative emotions.
So none of them are in the buddhi.
No, the buddhi actually comes into relationship with those. If it doesn't come into relationship, then the manas is overwhelming the buddhi. Right? And so then the buddhi is speaking out of the manas. And it can feel so definite about everything. It's just in a deluded state. It's being deluded by being overwhelmed, like a tidal wave, overwhelmed by the manas or by the emotion. And then it's really the emotion who's speaking. But that can be changed the instant the buddhi just said, becomes aware of the emotion. All it has to say is, I know you're upset. Boom. Now we have buddhi and manas. I know you're upset. Tell me about it. What's happening? Or it says, that's okay. You can be with me. Then I become the one who's aware, right? So these are just tricks to break through this total overwhelm of the emotion, you know. But when you're overwhelmed in the emotion, sometimes you have to remember to do that. You also, you're identified with that emotion and into it, and building a web around yourself with it. But it gets to a point where that doesn't happen anymore. That's what I say. Once you're willing to start actually doing some of these things, it's really the beginning of the end. There's all these years back, infinite lifetimes up until that point.
And then how much power does that have? I mean, is there much in relationship to this technique?
It's all good because you become a mumukshu. Once you become a mumukshu, that doesn't mean you're willing to do all of these sadhanas. But you want to know, and that's for real. You want to know, and then it takes, just think, beginningless lifetimes, and you're in a hurry now.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But it's been beginningless lifetimes. But now we are, I've got 10 minutes.
Yeah. I got 10 years.
No.
You know?
Well, 10 years is being generous. Most people don't have 10 years. When they start, I want this now. This has to happen right now. You know? Give me the Shakti pot. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Give me, electrocute me.
Bring out the peacocks rather than touch me.
But the thing is, when this knowledge takes place, things start to change. And slowly your mind, it starts giving up. It's holy cows. Sometimes Swamiji calls them that. These holy cows, you know. These things I'm so attached to and committed to, which can be your emotions too, your reactions, your angers, your frustrations, you know, the things you're bitter about in life, you know, what other people are doing, politics, all of this, you know, can just, we're really just taking our rage out and frustration out on whatever. There comes a time when it's not worth it to you anymore. Just simply not. And then all of these sadhanas, to call sadhanas, actually just become natural. They become just the way your mind works. Like, why would you choose to get upset? For what? Really, when you really analyze it, getting all angry and upset.
Knotted up.
And then you start to figure out, well, why? What am I going to gain? What is anybody going to gain out of it? There's usually no gain. Literally. It's really funny. No gain, no advantage. And there's so many advantages to just being happy. You know? And it's easy to be happy. It's very easy to be happy because it's your own nature. And it's here. You know, that's the thing. It's here. You don't need to do this circuitous route to get this person to behave this way and that person to behave that way and that object to come my way. Mm. So that my mind will relax so I can have a moment of happiness. That's samsara. But the jnanam is not like that. I am the source of the ananda, and my mind and myself is the very self of the mind, so there's no distance between me and my mind. And so I do not need these circuitous routes. They're not meaningful. They're not necessary. That's why in the end of our maturing process, it's just, this is the prarabdha karma. This is the karma that caused me to take this birth and will take me all the way through to my death. And I'm happy to just be with this. That's what Swamiji says, honestly. And I know it's the absolute truth, and I see myself, you know, gradually moving into this reality where it's, this is fine. Mm-hmm. This is fine, you know. This is the prarabdha. This is where I took this birth. And so let me just live it to the best of my ability. Let me be helpful in whatever way. Because it's much nicer to be helpful than to not be helpful. Why should I be in this situation? And let me be as unhelpful as I possibly can. You know, why? There's no happiness in it. There's no joy in it. And then what are the other things you can say is, I don't want this situation. I want another situation. That's a real problem. Because this is the situation you have right now. And what if you've got the other situation? Then that'll happen too. I don't want this situation. I want another situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, what situation do you want?
You should just want the one that you have.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Can the manas be converted into the buddhi, or the manas will still stay?
The manas is a faculty.
Okay.
And so the faculty can just be functioning, you know, with the thoughts that are passing through, with the perceptions.
But why does it have to become sad? But
it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be sad. Sometimes it is sad, though. Sad,
okay.
Sadness is a reaction.
Of the manas?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
If you want to distinguish, we say we put that in the manas.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the buddhi is the one that is aware of the sadness, dealing with the sadness, or overwhelmed by the sadness.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Is it possible to keep
the manas? Is saying, I am sad.
Okay. Is it possible to keep the manas happy?
It's very possible to keep the manas happy. It's the manas that has the emotional lag time.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Yeah. The manas starts becoming very subdued and just functioning as an instrument instead of becoming full of clouds, cloudy and reactionary. Yeah. David?
So, kind of on a different tack here. So, Maya is what has resulted in all this duality. Is Maya a power that Brahman has?
We wouldn't say it quite like that, because Brahman, just as conscious being,
mm-hmm.
which never changes, that is not subject to time or space. Time and space belong to Maya. Okay?
Right.
So Brahman is not doing anything to even think, oh, I have the power Maya.
Mm-hmm.
There's no duality even have thought. It's just is conscious being, which is the very self of the whole creation. Maya is what we would say is an incidental attribute of Brahman. Why Swamiji says incidental? We would say mitya for us. We say mitya. It's mitya, Brahman is satyam. But say we use English. Then we say it's an incidental attribute, means Maya doesn't cause any change in Brahman at all.
Mm.
It does. It's not a second. It has no second being. It's only an incidental attribute that if you were to analyze Maya, like say here in the creation, this is all Maya, or the creation according to the Upanishads, you know, manifests and resolves cyclically from beginningless time. And that is the very nature of the creation. It's something that is Brahman with this Maya that manifests in terms of the entire time-space creation, all duality included in it. It means all time and space included in it, all the lokas, all of the different worlds, heaven worlds, hell worlds, this world, all subtle worlds, gross worlds, physical worlds, everything that exists within duality is from the Maya. Maya enjoys totally conscious being for itself, existence, the Sat-Chit, which is Brahman, existent conscious being, every aspect of it. There's nothing ever away from that in any way. So what we would say, you're like this room. If we want, this room is Maya, our little piece of Maya. This body is Maya. Sense organs are Maya. Thoughts, moods, emotions are Maya. Everything that exists within duality is Maya. And every part of this experience enjoys Sat-Chit. Every part is, it is, it is, it is, it is, equally. This isn't more is than this is. Everything enjoys being equally. It's pervasive, because that's Atma, that's Brahman. And everything is known. And everything in your experience is known. That's also Brahman, because the nature of Brahman is consciousness. And the word we use in English for Brahman in reference to an object which, like the chair consciousness, we say the chair is known, the table is known, this body is known, these sense organs are known, the mind is known, the moods are known, perceptions are known, everything is known. The knownness, if I took away all nama-rup, all name and form, what is left is the knownness, which is the self-evident consciousness. Knownness is consciousness. When we use this word, it is known, it is known, it is known, that's like saying table consciousness, painting consciousness, rug consciousness, body consciousness, you know, shirt consciousness, hair consciousness, right? Consciousness is what is actually here. And all of these nama-rupas, really, are really nothing but consciousness in terms of what is here, but the nama-rupa, the informed aspect of it, is what we call Maya. And that's why in the analysis, the Upanishadic analysis, we go into this Maya that we experience as matter, as physical matter, as though there's a real world here, different from consciousness. We analyze it, and you have to say, no, there's nothing here. Everything is infinitely divisible. There's an infinite regress in terms of divisibility, in terms of space, and in terms of time. Right? You can't. Time is past, present, future. So try to find the present. Past is gone. Future's not here. Okay? Past is not here. So that's out of the question. It's gone. Future's out of the question. It's not come. Let's find the present. But the present is infinitely divisible. Right? How small is the moment? Any moment is huge. Can be divided infinitely until you get to what we call a point. But a point doesn't take up any time, it doesn't take up any space. And so what happens, what you realize, is that actually the present is the presence of consciousness. Conscious being is always the present. For conscious being, there is never past or future. There is only present. And for us too, there is only present. The present, which is the presence of the present. You could never find the present here. And you can never find an object here. Every object is infinitely divisible into smaller and smaller parts. And so that's why Swamiji just says it's names within names within names within names within names of Brahman. Because there's nothing here but Brahman.
So this,
what I'm still working with, David.
But it seems like a contradiction logically to say that Brahman doesn't do anything. It takes no action.
It doesn't, though. The only thing that takes action is Maya, because how can consciousness...
Okay. Got it. What I'm saying is that Brahman takes no action, but happens to have an interdental attribute which takes action.
Mm-hmm.
It just sounds like pushing the goalpost down, I mean.
No, because it would be... If this Maya can bring about, can exist of its own accord... Number one, apart from conscious being, and if it can bring about a change in conscious being, then you can say it has some reality of its own.
I'm not trying to establish Maya being separate. I'm good with Maya being an incidental attribute of Brahman, but I'm still stuck.
But does it bring about a change to Brahman?
No, but it brings about a change in the duality.
That's okay. it is, it's responsible for duality. That's exactly what it does
do. I'm still on Brahman, doesn't take any action, but it has an incidental attribute, Maya, which makes all the action happen. So that's really the same as Brahman taking action.
But what if Brahman doesn't take any action? If consciousness is not doing anything?
What does this incidental attribute mean? It's an incidental attribute of Brahman.
What do you think we mean?
So it's of Brahman, therefore Brahman is taking the action.
Well, what if we don't... Incidental attribute is actually an English term that we use for Maya. Well, I don't want to get into that. Say if we just, instead of using incidental attribute, we say the order of reality, that duality that Maya enjoys, is what we call mitya. What is mitya? Mitya means the order of reality that it enjoys is that we can't call it satyam, this world that we experience. Satyam would mean that it can never be negated in past, present, or future. That's the definition of satyam.
Mm-hmm.
Non-negatable at any time. So we can't say that about this universe, because this universe is negating itself and changing all the time, every part of it. So it's not going to be satyam. And it's not going to be what we call tucham, which means absolute non-existence, because we experience it. So now we have this category that we call mitya, which is neither satyam, never negatable, changeless, or tucham, which is not here. So mitya is this in-between state. And so now for this mitya, we have another definition that says that which has no independent existence apart from its adhishtana. The adhishtana is what gives it being. So the example which gives it existence, which gives it being. So and the mitya satyam example would be like, for instance, rope snake. Right? The rope is not touched by the snake, but the snake is totally dependent for its being on the rope. Yeah. Or we use another type, clay pot, where this form, namarupa form, is not, it is totally dependent on the clay, but nothing happens to the clay. The clay is not dependent on it. From the standpoint of the clay, there is no pot. There's only clay. But then there's the pot. You can't say the pot doesn't exist. We say the pot is mitya.
But if we can't finally resolve unification of satyam and mitya, we have to be on the duality track.
To resolve that, we have to say that there's no duality, because there's no two equally existent things. If you say there's one thing there that is real, and there's one thing that is mitya, that doesn't make two.
Because mitya is Brahman, right?
Mm.
Well, mitya, you can't say mitya is Brahman, you can't say it's not Brahman either. Because Brahman is not changing.
It feels like cheating. You have an indefinable category that keeps slipping out whenever it tries to get pinned down.
It's an indefinable category, or I think we defined it pretty well, though.
Well, no, I mean, it's being defined, but it's almost like it's moving around, the definition.
I know, but look at the reality of this world that you experience. It has certain characteristics. One characteristic is just that it comes into being and goes out of being.
Right.
Anything in it comes into being and goes out of being. So then it's got non-being on either side. Anything that comes into being and goes out of being has non-being on either side. That means that while it is being there, it must be dependent on something other than itself, because nothing can come from non-being and go into non-being, so it must be dependent on something other than itself. That's the definition of mitya and satyam. Now, if you can't say about satyam that it comes into being and goes out of being, or it's not satyam.
Mm-hmm.
Don't worry, in the Mandukya we'll be stuck with this for quite a while. So. We'll be working away at it. Takes a while. No, don't. It's not fair to just dismiss it. Cause
I'm not.
Yeah, you have to stick with it and see it, because it's there
it.
To see.
It just feels like I'm not sure. I'm agreeing with what you're saying, but I'm not sure we're talking about what I meant. Maybe we are essentially, but I'm not getting it. We are.
Okay. We'll talk about it more.
Okay.
I heard David, like, at one point talk about how he doesn't see how Brahman, about doership or about doing that.
Or it's not
so
a doer.
So Brahman is not doing anything.
Uh-huh.
Everything is being done.
Uh-huh. What part of Brahman is doing something?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, anything that enjoys doership has got to exist within Maya. Because any type of doership requires time and space.
Mm.
Otherwise, there's no motion. If you're away from time and space, there's no motion. So you have to bring in time and space for any kind of doership. Or even a thought. Thought requires time and space.
Mm-hmm.
Thought has a beginning and end.
It seems like if you can't say Mithya is ultimately Brahman, it's reality. We have a duality as our philosophy.
What order of reality is this duality?
It comes and it goes, but there has to be only one thing. We can't have a Brahman that doesn't come and go, but yet there's this other stuff that comes and goes. That's duality.
It depends on the nature of the stuff that comes and goes. Like, do you think that there's duality between the rope and the snake?
Only with illusion and the snake.
Okay, well, this is the same thing, only with illusion.
Where's my mistake? Then I must have a mistake, so I'm asking where it is.
Well, I don't understand. Sorry.
I'm superimposing something. You brought up rope snake.
I'm using rope snake as an example between Satyam and Mithya, where something is totally dependent on something else as its adhishtana.
Mm-hmm.
Does it mean that there's two different orders? Is there a duality between the rope and the snake?
Mm-hmm.
A duality.
Is there duality?
Yes.
Yes?
Yes.
Okay, then you're saying something that itself has no intrinsic reality is illusory, as you say, which we have to analyze that, counts as two.
Well, there's a mistake in perception of the mind. That's one. There's an actual snake, a rope that I didn't see. That's two.
Okay, but I'm not talking about the snake. Talking about the mistake in your mind. That goes into a different subject matter. I'm talking about if you have like a rope snake, a snake that's misperceived on the rope. Now I just want you to look at the snake and the rope.
Are there two things?
Are there two things there?
Yes.
What are they?
There's the snake you saw, and there's the actual rope you saw later. That's two experiences. That's two things.
Okay.
Two memories.
You're going outside of the drishtanta illustration.
Okay. So, no. Then there's one.
Okay. Well, then we have to understand that this snake is Maya, and the rope is Brahman. And so that's what we have to keep unfolding. You know.
Okay.
Take some time. But I'm done. Are we done? Well, our time's up. That's all. I'm tired. It's 9:15. Yeah. I want to say a prayer.
Didn't you already say it?
What?
You already said it.
Swasti Pajaga?
Didn't?
No. Swasti prajabhya paripalayantam nyayena margena mahim mahishaha ko brahmanebhya shubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parjanyah prithivishasya shalini desho yamsho varahitah Brahmana santu nirbhayaha Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayaha Sarve bhadrani pasyantu Ma kaschit dukkha bhag bhavet Asato ma sargamaya
tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityorma amritam gamaya. Om purnamadah purnamidam purnat purnamudachyate, purnasya purnamadaya purnameva vashishyate. Om shanti shanti shanti. Harihi Om.